Slacker Podcast. Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Greetings, slackers. I hope you are all good. I hope your jowls are filled with very expensive gravy and coffee, and it is spilling down your chin right now, and you're just laughing to yourself maniacally, going, yes, rubbing your hands together, thinking, another fine, beautiful, award-winning Slacker podcast at my ears' fingertips. I've got a brand new podcast studio at the moment. So anybody who was listening to the podcast last week and they heard a really tinny sounding introduction, it is because I haven't figured out completely how to use all of the settings on my microphones. I bought microphones. I've bought a portable like little desk that I can bring with me because I plan on doing so much recording of podcasts for series 3 in autumn and winter this year. As the sun goes down, I come out with my backpack filled with leads and microphones and bits and pieces that I barely even know what to do with. All I know is that I've started putting some bids in for amazing guests for season 3. So if you have any suggestions, please send them to me. A friend of mine sent me like 5 suggestions last week, and all 5 of them I'd never even thought of, and I was like, wow, these are great. So yeah, feel free to like send them to me or DM me on Twitter or Instagram. It's at Philly Taggart, PhilyTaggart. Don't at Phil Taggart, because that poor guy gets sent tweets anytime I play anything on the radio. I'm kind of hoping that he just gives up on that Twitter handle and just like hands it over to me. Anyway, that just seems to be a little bit mean on that Phil Taggart. He could be setting up his own podcast and it might completely wipe our eye. If you're fresh to the Slacker podcast and you've never listened to any before, there's a whole wild universe out there of 2 series for you to go and listen to. This is the one with Lucy Rose, and we will get to her in just a second. If you enjoy Lucy Rose's music, then I think you might like the one that we recorded with Hozier, which I think was in season 1. You might like that one. You might like the Cribs one. Do you know what? There's like, you'll have found where to get this podcast because you're listening to it right now. You can just like go back through the 28 or 29 episodes that there are out there. This is the penultimate episode of series 2. We have only got 1 left to go. It was meant to be with Slaves, and it was meant to come out next week, but that's not happening now, so it might be a week or two till you get the very last one of series 2. So what else have I got to tell you before we get into this podcast? Oh yeah, BBC Introducing Live is happening. If you make music and you play in a band, or you're like in the industry in some sort of way, or you're just interested about how it all works, there's a massive thing happening at the Tobacco Dock at the very beginning of November. And it's over 3 days. It's got experts from all around the world and all sorts of different bits and pieces, facets of the music industry, from, say, like, you know, how you get your music put on like a TV show, all the way to how to go play festivals, how to do this, how to do that, looking after your mental health. And there's loads of performances. And like all the music companies come down, and there's loads of like last year I saw a couple of freebies being handed out here and there. And it was just good fun as well, because there's loads of people who are like-minded, all in the same place, playing music, learning about music. And it happens over 3 days. You can buy tickets on the link that I'll give below. And basically everything that I've just said on that, I've written a book about it. It's called The Slacker's Guide to the Music Industry. And it took me a couple of years to write. And it is basically the guide that you need if you're starting out in music. I wrote it with the idea of it being in somebody's keyboard case, somebody's guitar case, lying at the back of the practice room. It's 20 chapters long, and you can buy it from philtaggartslacker.com, or you can buy it from Amazon as well. I've been getting everybody to get it from my own website, but I think some people should buy it from Amazon now, because I really should have got like more people to review it on there. I was like so hell-bent and just saying, you know what, Jeff Bezos, you're not getting my 10%. And then I was thinking, do you know, I probably should have done that because the review system actually kind of works on it. Anyway, this is really boring for you because you've just tuned in and you want to hear Lucy Rose and me chat about her first ever demo. The track will be Middle of the Bed, which is taken from her very, very first album, which is called Like I Used To, which came out in 2012. Lucy Rose is a wonderful human being, a wonderful songwriter, and just incredibly interesting to sit down and speak with for roughly around an hour. It was the first podcast that I recorded in my house in Brighton. I think Lucy's just moved to Brighton as well. And yeah, it was really fun. I think we spent pretty much the first like 15, 20 minutes before we even switched the microphones on trying to figure out like whether I had parking permits or anything. So yeah, it got really interesting, very adult, very, very rock and roll. Yeah, we were like drinking whiskey through our eyeballs, or we just drank like a cup of tea and spat lyrical. It's not even words, is it? Spat lyrical. About her music and her career. Here we go. Our penultimate episode of series 2 of the Slacker podcast. This is Lucy Rose in 3, 2, 1. This is the Slacker podcast, and you've got myself, Phil Taggart, and we've got Lucy Rose. Hello.
Hi.
This is really weird because we're recording this in my kitchen. I've never recorded in the house before.
It's lovely.
Thanks very much.
It's very nice.
Do you
nice.
Like my Guinness painting? I'm obsessed with Guinness and cocktail sausages, and you put them
That's
together.
That's absolutely perfect.
Put it up in the kitchen. So what's going on? How are you doing? What's happening?
Yeah, I landed from Canada yesterday. It was quite a traumatic flight because it was 10 hours on a plane with no TVs and no food for 10 hours.
Oh my God, hold on, I'm going to close this door because I can hear the wind on the microphone. What do you do on a flight for 10 hours?
They told us at check-in, we were just like curious about the type of plane it was because it was a thing we'd never heard of. They said no TVs. It was built in the same year that I was born. It was 1989, 30-year-old plane. And it all still had all the ashtrays in it. It was super weird.
Did you just buy a load of cigarettes at duty-free and just spark up and smoke the
whole
way home?
You should be allowed to. If it's that old, you should be allowed to. But yeah, it was pretty grim, to be honest. Like, really grim.
I did a flight home from Thailand in... Was it 2013 or 2014? Whenever Ebola was like the big one.
Mm-hmm.
Remember everybody was talking about Ebola? It was just kicking off around that stage. And I'd done 2 weeks in Thailand with my now wife and a couple of friends. And I'd booked out a different time. So I was coming home by myself. And when I got to the airport, I like noticed this massive rash coming up my arm. And I freaked the fuck out.
Hell.
Oh my God. Genuinely thought like... I'm a hypochondriac at the best of times.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I'd convinced myself that I'd got Ebola. So I put a jumper on, went to the bar and sunk 3 whiskeys in a row to steady myself. Got on the plane and just sat there.
And then were you fine? Was it just a rash?
I think it was like, I had to take 2 weeks off work. It was some sort of virus or something. But there was like a little lady right beside me who had one of those like surgical masks on. And she was coughing like... the whole way home. That was the worst flight I've ever had. Like,
there's always one. This one was a little bit like engine failure. We like boarded twice, and then the weight was wrong because they were trying to make money from putting cargo on, but they were like unsure of how to pack it in a way that the flight made the plane like stable. This is what they told us.
Are you like that's too much information?
Yeah, they were like, and then they're like, and we've got to be really careful because we're flying over a lot of water. So it's like, okay, I'm glad we're being extra careful today.
Yeah.
It was just like grim. Everything they told us was grim.
So we start every podcast with a demo, but you just had to be a little bit difficult, didn't you? You were like, no, I'm not giving you a demo. Because you don't demo, do you?
Well, I do demos, but I don't keep anything.
Like, do you not keep all that stuff for B-sides and rarities and all that?
Nope.
How are you going to bluster up your album in like 10 years' time when you've got to go sell it again?
It's fine. This whole point is like, you can't do that.
Yeah.
I never know if that's actually a good idea, really, to start putting out old things from 20 years ago.
I mean, weren't
good enough at the time and now are slightly good enough to put out. I just don't... I feel like it's like seeing all of the like... bad promo photos that you don't want anyone to see. Like, that's just the way I see it. I feel like with a lot of old stuff, I don't keep anything, you know, like, my husband's really different. He'll keep, like, all the lanyards from every festival we do. All of it freaks me out.
Yeah.
It's like clutter. And the same on my computer. It's just, like, all becomes too much. My inbox, I pretty much just, like, delete everything in it every 6 months because the thought of having, like, thousands of emails is way too much.
If I showed you my promo email address, you'd probably have like
I think delete the whole account. That's where I would be at with it at a certain point. I don't really keep.
If you look at artists like Jimi Hendrix, right? Like, or even Jimi Hendrix is a good example. Didn't record that many albums, but how many records has he got out? Like, there's a million live ones, there's like so many demos. Like, I remember the Smiths had a song that had the lyrics reissue, repackage. It's just record labels trying to coin in, isn't it? Or estates trying to coin in.
I think there's some people, obviously, it's great. Like, this, I find it, like, fascinating to hear how things have developed and you can hear, like, oh, this is where it was. But for me, it's like, I just think it's just so exposing. And listening back to myself, I don't even know if I would have demoed anything. I just think I just played songs and played them live. And that was it. I don't think I spent a lot of time demoing anything or stuff.
Do you like live albums?
Yeah.
I don't like live albums.
I like
Neil, I'm either there like or I'm not.
Neil Young's live record. I think that's the only one that I listen to.
The only one that I don't give live albums much of a chance because the way I feel about it is you're either there or you're not. The only one I do like is. Obviously, I like the two big ones. For being a teenage boy, the Metallica S&M one was incredible. And the band.
Nice.
Yeah.
I just think you have to love an artist a lot. And at that point, when you're the favourite thing in the world, like Neil Young or Joni Mitchell's like my favourite artist in the world, then I want it all. Mm. And it's all amazing and it's all great.
You listen to his rarities and demos and stuff.
Yeah, I would, yeah, definitely.
But see, some of you might feel like that about your stuff too.
Yeah, I guess I just don't have the confidence that that's the case. Mm. I feel like nowadays I'm trying to get my records out into the world and people to have time to do it. It feels like it's a weird time, you know, like because I absolutely love streaming and everything, but when everything's on the end of your fingertip and you're sort of just going down your screen, what makes someone put on my record over, like, the thousands and thousands of other records that there are out there, I feel like baffles me,
Somebody referred to when I was doing an interview for the lovely book that you were a part of, The Slacker's Guide to the Music Industry, and they referred to streaming as, like, gas pumped into your house. And I was like, it's really good. That does feel like what it is.
I'm actually kind of lying about whether I have demos. I do have demos. I just don't like technology and they're on a hard drive that I am incapable of working. So it's like when my computer, you know, when your computer just combusts at a certain time because it's so old.
Yeah.
When it combusts, I took it to Apple and said, it's combust, really. It's exploded. Could you just put everything on a hard drive? And I'm going to buy a new one, pretty much, which they did. But I've never been brave enough to open the hard drive.
That's going to be really fun, though. It's going to be like a time capsule when you open it.
And I actually feel like I've lost the hard drive as well. It's somewhere, but I have no idea where it is.
Oh, my God, that's so stressful.
And I feel okay about it. I actually feel probably less stressed that I don't know where it is.
Fair enough. You should just throw it into the sea. Get rid.
Yeah, most probably.
Let's play this track, though. This is... Middle of the Bed from your first album, which came out in 2012, and was like, we'll talk a little bit about it after, but we'll listen to it first.
I sleep in the middle of the bed. You don't know, is it fine to hold my hand? I sleep in the middle of the bed. Sand slips through my cold hand. Do you really want me back? Do you really want me back? 'Cause I'm over it.
That was Lucy Rose and Middle of the Bed, taken from Like I Used To, which came out in 2012. Is that one of the first songs you ever wrote?
Yeah, it's up there. Well, probably not actually. There was like a big bunch of songs that I wrote at the beginning that were all terrible. That's the first one I wrote that was, I think, decent within the first few of them, but yeah, I wrote a lot of songs before then.
How did you know that that one was like a step up, like a level up?
I don't know if I did at the time, really. Mm. I think that I started playing things live. That always makes a difference to see people's reactions to stuff live at like little open mics. Like, oh, that one was really good that you played, you know, and then you get a few more comments about that and feel a bit better about the song. And
do you almost need that sort of that hype, like the validation of people going, that's actually a good one? Do you need that, like, when you're starting out and you're writing?
Yeah, I think I need that all the time.
Yeah,
to be honest, like,
who's your hype man or woman?
I don't know. I mean, it can be anybody, really. I'm not that picky, to be honest. Like, I feel like if anybody that is connected to something or enjoyed something I've done, it makes a big difference to how I feel about it all. I find it very difficult to look back on anything and feel really proud of anything that I've done. It feels like way too close, and I don't know. It's just weird, really.
Is it not like? Is there not enough gap between 2019 and 2012 that you can kind of almost look back on it and think?
I think it makes it worse.
Really?
Mm.
Do you not think it almost feels like you're a different person? Because like, what's that? 7 years? So, like, you would have been 22.
Yeah, I just think it just feel like, oh, I can't listen to it without hearing all the mistakes and the faults in it.
Can you because I mean, the layman's ear that I have picks up nothing. Like, on the little bit that we just heard, like,
well, I just think,
is it guitar slides? Is it vocal?
No, I just tuning? It's mainly vocal stuff. I just think, God, I sound so young then, and
but that's part of it, isn't it?
I just, yeah, it's really, maybe I think I might need to be like 100 years old to feel like, oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's just like, I can't feel like that. I mean, it's really difficult to listen back to anything, and really.
Does that make it difficult when you come to like mixing an album or
you've recorded? Oh, at the time I always feel okay about it.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like at every point until the day it's released, I feel okay about it. And then it's released into the world, and then at that point I let go of having any sort of opinion on it, really.
It's not yours anymore then?
It's not mine. And I know that at that moment in time I've done the best I can. Mm-hmm. Don't feel like I would have ever not given it 100% of my thought and attention on like every single part of the record. So at that point I feel good about it. But looking back, you wonder, like, I wonder why I did that, and I wonder why I sang it like that. I wonder why my accent was like that, or why, you know, all the different things that you think about.
Mm-hmm.
It's really difficult. It's like, I don't know. I don't know if anyone really, like, I would hope that you could look back at old photos of yourself and love them. I feel like we've reached an age where when we look back at like baby photos, or like when we're like 3 and 4, you know, like people using it for like EP shots and things like that.
Yeah, that's very,
and,
like, very,
you know what
common.
I mean? It's
yeah.
Like, oh, it's actually, it's like, oh, look, that's, I feel nostalgic about that.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think anyone would use like a photo that was like 7 years old. I feel like I'm at that point with it.
You know what I mean?
You would just choose like a 7 year old photo, like as in like 7 years ago where I'm 18 for my new EP shot.
But maybe
would
you
that
will
be really random.
Maybe you will when you're older. My mum.
Yeah, maybe it has to be like the big enough gap. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't make sense.
My mum has a photo of herself that she has on the fridge from when she was about 30, maybe like late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because like she's like, right, I want to get back to that sort of you know, that physique, and I'm just like, that's crazy. Like, but like maybe that's the sort of distance that you need to give. Like, does it need to be like 30 years?
Potentially needs to be like 20-30 years for you to like look back at yourself and enjoy what you see in a way, in any way. If I look back at photos of myself when I was like 19 or first started releasing this sort of stuff when I was 20, it's the exact same thing. It's like, why am I wearing those purple jeans? You know, it's like, it feels almost identical.
So when you like, when you started off like in, like you know, with music, like can you remember like the first track that you remember hearing in your house? Was it a musical household that you came from?
No, not at all. I remember, I think we were just very normal when it came to music. We listened to the
whatever's
radio
on
to school, yeah. We were very influenced by, you know, we'd fight between my mum wanted to listen to Radio 2 and we wanted to listen to Radio 1, and we'd argue about that and split the time. And that was all the real music that I heard, particularly, was just on the way to school and back. And then when it was started, you know, HMV became a thing, you can go and buy CDs. Like, I was, again, just really influenced by my friends, really, what my friends were listening to.
So what sort of stuff were you like, listening to? Like, when you were, what were the first sort of CDs that you were buying? No, be honest about it, because I'll be honest.
Terror is so funny.
I'll be honest about
like
it.
Like, at the time, like, Green Day was massive.
Yeah, Green Day is still great.
Like, I remember having, like, a Papa Roach CD, which is so
We would have got on so well.
Yeah, I was like, I was cool in being, like, on point with taste. But that period of time was, like, Papa Roach, Limp Bizkit, Green Day.
We were into the same sort of stuff. Like, it's very hard to look back at the sort of new metal phase and be proud of it. Like, I feel like in like, I'm obsessed with tribes and movements, and, you know, you look back at new romantics and punks and skinheads and the hip hop culture and all the rest of it. And sometimes I just get a little bit deflated to think that, you know, in my prime, mine was new metal and new rave, which are, like, two of the shittest movements of all time.
It's very hard to be like...
Did you know what I mean? It's not exactly...
Look back on it really fondly, even though they were great at the time. I mean, I didn't even know if I was in a move. Like, you know what I mean? When you're listening, I was
You don't know it at the time,
I didn't even know what, like, music culture was or...
Did you have a wallet chain?
A what?
Did you have a wallet chain? A chain that goes from your wallet
onto my jeans.
Onto your jeans?
Yes, I did.
Did you have a studded belt as well?
I remember trying to start skateboarding at a period of time when I was like 12 or 13.
Yeah, that's about when I started too.
Yeah, like I'm going to start skateboarding. I mean, like, all of that sort of Avril Lavigne was coming out as well at the same time. That was the first concert I went to.
Avril Lavigne?
It was Avril Lavigne, yeah. Birmingham, yeah.
Full on skater boy?
Yeah, definitely. Like, had the, like, beanie hats, you know, like, baggy trousers. I think, was it, like, Etnies? What those trainers?
Yeah, yeah, Etnies, DCs.
DCs they were in.
You were buying all your stuff from Roller Snakes magazine, probably.
I mean, it's so bad because it feels like I have nothing to relate to that time.
No, me, like,
you know
me,
what I mean?
Either.
It's so weird.
I'm still into, like, quasi-aggressive music. But, like, I quite like heavy music. I mean,
I have nothing that I could say was part of me within that. I was just, like, very... I felt like as a child was just... Or a teenager, I was just a sheep.
But that, I think that's fine. I think I was the same.
It was totally normal. But it was just... I wasn't, like, one of those people who just was, like, you know, uber, like... You know, I guess when you do come from, like, a really musical background and you've got, like... You know, the education of what it all means and those sort of things, and then you can be like, carve your own path. Like, I was so late on before I started, like, carving my own identity, my own path. It took me, like, a really, really long time to
do
that.
I don't feel like I came into myself until about 22, 23, 24, really, if I'm being honest about it. It's a good thing maybe you didn't have a guitar or you didn't start playing, like, Papa Roach stuff at that age.
I know,
because
yeah.
Like, this could be a very different conversation.
Well, I feel like when I first started playing guitar, I was like 15. I think I saved up, or 16, I got one and taught myself, and I was still in that phase, but coming out of it was like the first songs that I ever learned to play was Iris, Goo Goo Dolls.
Yeah, that's a classic.
When it first came out, and I was like, oh my god, this is like emotional. I'm gonna get real stuck into this.
Did you do Zombie as well?
No, I just did the one. That was the only cover I've really, like, done until... And that just taught me some chords. And it was in an odd tuning, which is really why I've written nearly all my songs in different tunings, not standard. And
so you weren't... You didn't, like... You don't have a litany of covers that you can sort of rely on? Like,
no,
you know, when
covers are just, like, really one of the banes of my life.
But if I picked up that guitar now, there's a certain amount of... riffs that I've got in my head that I learned when I was maybe 17.
Nope.
Like Black Dog by Led Zeppelin would be like maybe the first one that I would go to.
No. I don't have anything.
You're I don't respect it. Other people to cover their stuff. I'm just doing my own.
I feel like I just had a point, like when you're in your head, of remembering things. You know, when the cabinets are full and everyone talks about every time you fill up a new cabinet, some stuff is lost.
Yeah.
And I feel like with lyrics, I know I've only got 4 records, but with lyrics and chords and my own songs, that takes up like a big part of my cabinet section of what I can remember.
Yeah.
And with covers, I think potentially because I don't ever really, you know, I feel like some people like adore their music and really, I find that very difficult to have that sort of opinion about me and my music.
Mm.
And, but when it's mine, it's mine.
Yeah.
But if I'm covering someone, I just would just be my worst critic. Like, that's just a terrible version of a great song.
So you,
so I just would feel like I can't do that.
When, but like around 2012, you were with a major record label, and that was exactly the same time that it was really popular to take a massive song and half speed it. You know, the John Lewis ads and stuff like that. Surely your record label was probably coming to you going, would you do this for this ad? Would you do that? Because like, surely they would have been trying to commercialize.
Well, I guess so. I mean, at every point, I remember when Kate Nash became the thing and I was like doing open mics and stuff at the time. And Kate Nash became really big, and then it, then another something else became really big, and it was like, oh, you've missed your moment. That was like your window, was like that whole Kate Nash world and all this stuff. And
yeah,
then that went and, you know, it just disappeared. And, someone says it, and I just saw that's just the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard, because why is there only like a fashionable time for certain type of music to come out? I think when I, before, my first record obviously came out in 2012, but before then I'd been doing gigs for a long, long time and been, you know, touring, supporting Bombay Bicycle Club for like 2 or 3 years, or 2 years. And in a nutshell, at that first record, no one really pushed me around too much at the label. But at the end of it, yeah, there was, can you go for the John Lewis adverts? And can you go for this? And there was often like a demo fee with those sort of things, where they'll pay you like 500 quid or something to demo something. And then you kind of go in your head like, well, take me half a day, I mean, I can make 500 quid, which would be amazing.
Yeah.
So you do it. It's like any breakdown of any relationship. I don't think you realise at the time how unhappy you are, you know? You really don't.
You just keep on going.
You keep going and you keep trying to make it work. And you keep, because, you know, at the beginning of things, it was like a dream come true, like being signed and, you know, there was everything I'd like aspired to be.
But that's what all musicians want to do at the start, so, somebody to work with them and
someone believes in you. It's like, who's important. When you've got A&Rs trying to sign you, it is like a sort of, you kind of do fall in love with, you know, a person, and you go, this person really gets me and they believe me, and it feels really like a lot.
Did you have a lot of labels coming after you, like people asking you to sign to their label? Like, was there a lot of whining and dining and going, Lucy, we really understand you, it's a great vibe? And
yeah, I mean, you get all of it. Like, I mean, with my publisher, I remember I had a few publishers. There was one point of time where it just like happened, you know, and I'd been turned down, or no one was interested in me for 5 years or something. And then suddenly, yeah, like people turning up to my gigs with like really expensive bottles of champagne, you know, like,
I just think this is hilarious, because like, this is what, like, you know, people who are so out of touch with young people think that they will impress young people.
It's like your limousines, uncle coming, yeah, exactly.
And champagne, it's all a bit creepy, like, you know.
And I remember, and this, yeah, I got a, and it, my publishing, the person that kept like coming and wanting to sign me, really nice guy, but and they're just doing what they think is the right thing, and I guess most people are impressed with it, with champagne and those sort of things. And then I think the week after I signed to them, he got fired and nobody picked me up as something that they wanted to work on.
Yeah.
And then a year later I was dropped. So like, it's just the classic story that we've heard a million times.
Yeah. Somebody signs you up, gets the boot. And because the turnover at those places is ridiculously high as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. But at that point, when the end of the second record, and then when I came back from Latin America after doing that trip, I did just have a real, you know, I was like, I want to make a record which most probably 100% I can guarantee no one at radio is going to want to play. Like, this is, I'm not making a radio record. I'm not making singles on this record.
Funny because those are normally the records that radio does play. It's normally,
yeah, sometimes.
It's normally the ones that, I mean, like, for me, I can spot it a mile away. Like, bands, artists that are making an album, and you can just tell that they really want it to be commercial and they want it to be really successful. And that almost ruins it. And you're just a little bit like, oh, I don't want to play it.
I mean, I can say, like, that record, like, I think we got a little bit of radio play, but not really, you know, like compared to my other ones. And I think, yeah, I do. There's obviously a moment where you do start, you don't realize it, but you're writing music for different reasons. I mean, I just, I don't feel like I could judge any artist because I've been there. So it's from being there and understanding the pressures. And also what you get told is good is like, obviously you think it being played on radio and it being commercial and people liking it, there's still a lot of people I know, artists, who still go, yeah, what's wrong with that? You know, I want lots of people to be happy and enjoy my music. Yeah. I don't really see what the big sin is here. And I think the whole point is just for no one to judge anybody, whatever path they decide to take. The judgment part of it is what's, I think, can sometimes be the, I guess, the thing that can ruin things, irrelevant to what, because I do respect everyone for their own choices musically, and there's enough going on of different things.
What about those people that just have a good voice but can't write songs?
Yeah,
don't
I don't...
Like those people that have all the songs written for them and they're just like sort of a pop star. Can you get on with that?
Yeah, I think I can. Because I feel like there's a lot of music snobbery generally in the world of people going, that person doesn't deserve to be there. And, you know, there's a load of people that, you know, you meet every day who are in bands who are brilliant, but it just kind of like allowed that part of the industry to like make them so bitter that they don't even concentrate on what they're doing anymore. It's just all about like who these people at the end of the day, if like, I don't know who's an example of someone who, Little Mix or something, say they don't write their songs. I don't know if this is even factual, I have no idea. However, if there's like people that Little Mix are making happy,
it doesn't matter.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell? Like if there's people listen to a Little Mix song who go, my day feels better now, or I felt really down this morning and I've just put that song on and I feel better, I really don't care who's written it. Like, that's the whole point. And I do think like there's no real place for music snobbery of like who wrote what. I think people just need to concentrate on their own paths.
To be fair, if you're into authenticity and credibility, then the likelihood of you listening to Little Mix is probably next to zero anyway. So like,
well, it's the same as everything.
There's a space for both, isn't there?
100%. And it's just, I mean, I don't think people owe anything to anybody. You know what I mean? Like, it's the same as like politics or being well read about everything. We're all so obsessed with knowing everything about everything and being super well read and all of those things. It's like, you know, do I need somebody to know everything about the music industry and be like, oh, should I listen to this because of all of these different factors, whether they're like sincere or authentic and stuff? It's like, it's not your job to do that. Don't worry about it.
I think there's a real moment in time over the last like 5 years where people are talking with gusto about stuff they only know half about. Like there's I find that like a lot, like definitely in the music industry, like definitely when I was like writing that book. But
what do people have gusto about?
But I just think, I think it's Twitter. I think like it's Instagram and social media. It's like, if you have a conversation with somebody, it's all very reasonable and stuff, but people will go find one article, take a little bit out of it, and then like start slamming it home going, this is exactly how I feel and exactly what I think, but I haven't done any reading around it.
Yeah,
everybody's very confident in the...
I mean, obviously you all have your own opinions deep down, but I just don't know what makes people think that they're valid. Like, you know, sort of thing. Like, I've got like loads of opinions of like music I think is better and I think is, you know, more credible and authentic and all of those things that are important to me.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that I think that my opinion should be agreed on by every single person in the world. Like, I don't think that's realistic, and I don't want to drill it home until everyone does that, because then it would be quite boring. Like, that sounds so... You know.
So what you're saying is you're going to be the next Katie Hopkins of music. You're going to
Jesus Christ. No, I just, it's difficult. You see, like, you know, there's lots of, like, I love, you know, Jake Bugg's brilliant, but he had a big issue, you know, early on, didn't he, with like One Direction co-writing. And I remember him like saying a load of things about how he thought it was, there were musicians and all of
he
those things.
He did a
things.
Lot of co-writes. So
and then, yeah, like two records later, it's like he'd done loads of co-writes. And it's just like, there's nothing wrong with that either.
Do you co-write with people?
Never.
Never.
Never. Every single song.
Have you ever, like, I'm sure...
I've had to do one.
I'm sure you've had to go in and do sessions.
That was, again, another turning point, the breakdown of the relationship. I think my label at the time were like, your band's a bit old and uncool and we need them to be really cool and young looking and it's important that the session band like look good.
You're like, okay, I'll just go sack my friends.
And I was like, these are like my best mates who've been with me from the start. There's no way that's happening. And it was like, you've either got to do a co-write with somebody.
Did you tell them that the label had said that?
No.
Do they know?
I mean, they're not stupid. Like, the label probably made them feel shit all the time. Like,
yeah.
I don't really know. It's such a long time ago. I think there's a point where
guys,
can you maybe not wear like wife beaters on stage or something?
That's a vest for anybody who's listening.
Yeah, a vest or something. But then you're like, why? If they want to wear a vest, you know, in hindsight, that's some of my biggest regrets is even letting any of that infiltrate me into me going, do you think you could just like, you know, tone it down and not wear it? It's like, that's one of my biggest regrets, honestly. And in the end, I had to do one co-write. It was like, either we're getting a new band or you've got to do this one co-write. So I was like, fine, I'm going to go do this co-write and make this person's life misery for a day, whoever person I'm in this room with. And I think it was worse for them. They just were like, at one point, they're like, why are you here? It's like, I don't know, because I've been blackmailed. That's why I'm here. So it was just a terrible day. It was terrible, 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 terrible day for that poor, poor person.
I've seen artists on my label going into like a co-write or two at mm-hmm. the very, very beginning and come out going, why? What? Like, and they've never done it again afterwards. They've just been like, that was like a therapy session. Like, that wasn't a co-write.
I mean, it's a very depressing thing. The thought of going and telling a stranger all these things about myself, like the person I did one was with, oh, you've got to open up more. Like, Ellie Goulding was in here last week and she told me that like, she was kissing like two different boys at the same time and really didn't know what to do. And we wrote this great song about it. And I was just like, no, this is no, I don't feel. And also it was all like deep on like the most shallow sense of the word. It's like, if you genuinely wanted to talk about like something, it's really deep that you're like, this is an important issue to me with like the multiple layers of, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll just be like, yeah, that's not going to really work. Do you think we could just like simplify it? So it's just like, you know, you had a bad day, but a cup of tea made you feel a bit better. You know what I mean? And we'll just write about that. It's like, what?
Yeah, but
the
we'll change tea to like a woman.
And they'll just
and
be
we'll
like,
change the day to heartbreak.
Exactly. And it was just like, they had pages of like words, like title words, like hurricane or like, you know, like big words that we can use to describe feelings in a way that you've not heard before, but in like really terrible. It's like a metaphor just and a metaphor and a metaphor of like
a thesaurus.
Yeah. And it's just like, this is terrible. And I mean, that was depressing. And it's also, I've done a few, like, with my publisher being like, can you write for other people, where the tables are turned at this point later on? Because I've written these songs on my own and now it's like the odd person is like, thinks they're okay and would want to do a co-writing session with me for them. But then that's kind of depressing as well, because it'd be like, okay, I heard this song on Radio 1 the other day and it had this like really cool beat, so maybe we'll start from that. Like, people who have done so many sessions now, I don't know if they really know how to like genuinely from their soul write a tune.
Yeah,
you know. And it's like that's completely disappeared from great musicians who are young talents, just done so many sessions. I don't think it's just gone.
The last 2 years, specifically like mainstream music, has all been the
That's like the reggaeton, like boom,
yeah.
Everything's got that on at the moment.
Everything has had that for I'd say about 18 months, 2 years. And then I was spying indie bands coming out with tracks that have, and I'm like, that is the least indie or rock or, I mean, like, I don't want to pigeonhole a band to saying that they can't express themselves. Like that's stupid, considering one of my favorite bands in the whole wide world is The Clash, who mm-hmm. jumped into reggae and beat poetry and like, you know, Latin music. But when you're just jumping on board the cynical beat train, do you know what I mean? It's like, do you remember when like EDM was a thing like a couple of years ago?
Yeah,
everything had that rise, and like in pop music.
I think for young bands, there's nothing more exciting when someone, because I remember people saying, who's your biggest influence? Who influences you? And you remember being like, don't know really.
Satan.
Like, yeah, you just don't, when it's like, when you've discovered your own thing and you don't feel like it, you know, in that way. So when there's like young bands, you're like, I really can't think of who it is, then that's like I genuinely am most excited when I hear that. Because as soon as someone goes, oh yeah, well, this person and this person, then you kind of feel like there's a chance that they've listened to songs and like started off their own writing from an idea. Like the amount of stories I've heard of people going like, oh, I love this song, what can I take from this as a starting point for my own song? And that's just the opposite, again, of what I'm interested in.
Somebody said to me that the best artists are the ones that are really bad at copying other artists.
Yeah, he can't copy anybody.
So they might sit down and go, oh, like, I really like this sound, I'll try and do it. And then they do it and their own complete own sound comes out.
Yeah.
I understand that. So getting back to the start, actually, I want to talk about the first few gigs, because we talked about it in the book a little bit. I thought it was really interesting. Your first show was in London, wasn't it? It was like an open mic night.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, when we talked about it, you told me that you were like really shy and it was really difficult for you to get on stage. How did you go about that?
I took a couple shots, yeah. I did two. My sisters came and we did a shot.
Sister support.
Of whiskey each. And
I'm not saying that has to be, like, that's good advice for anybody that's listening to this.
Oh my God, I've got no good advice for anybody. That's just like a disclaimer of this whole podcast and my life going forward. These are just my opinions and none of it is to be taken as advice. And I'd never used a microphone before, so that was a really weird sensation, hearing my voice amplified for the first time and using a mic. It was
I found it really funny. I've been to like loads of open mic nights, and when you can tell when somebody's quite nervous and they're getting up, and they sort of plug the guitar in, they sort of awkwardly tune it or very silent, and then they start singing because they've never sung into a mic before, and they're either way too loud or they're just like,
you know, so far away.
Yeah,
you got a lot to learn from those sort of things. I mean, for me, I did. I've seen some people who've recently in Mexico City, I had a friend support me and it was his first ever gig. He was super nervous and he got up and it looked like he'd just been doing it for 20 years. It was just amazing. One of the most exciting things I'd seen in so long.
It's like a duck to water. Some people just get there faster, yeah, don't they?
100%. And for me, it was like a long, long process of a lot of open mics and a lot of like sort of re-education within music as well. For me,
what's it like going and playing those open mics? Where were you doing them? Were they like all across London? You just sort of like running about the tube on your...
Yeah, I had a job at Caramillan working in the shop, and then in the evening I would just get on the tube, work my way around London, whatever pub had an open mic, go put my name down, sit down, you know, grab a sandwich from a Sainsbury's and sit and have a drink and wait for my turn. Did that every night for like probably a year and a half.
Wow, like that's like earning your stripes there.
Yeah, yeah, big time.
And like you just moved to London as well, around that period as well. So like obviously you probably made a lot of friends from doing that. No? Is there not people on the circuit? Like would there not be other people similar to you doing that?
Did I make friends? No, I don't think I have.
They were the competition.
No, it was like a lot of men. There was a lot of men at these open mics. Rarely saw another girl doing it.
What sort of stuff were they singing?
There's a lot of like old men, you know, at a lot of the open mics. I mean, I started on one of the guys who was really nice. We'd started doing like a book club. He'd give me a book to read every week, and every Tuesday I'd come back and have read it. And that was
very wholesome,
nice,
isn't it?
For a while, yeah. I mean, there's lots of people that I'd done... seen at open mics which did become friends, like Simba, who played bass with me.
I love Simba. I've met him a few times. He's lovely.
He like he's one of my best mates now, but he was the person who did that very first open mic. He was the sound engineer. So yeah, I did meet friends from it. I'm just remembering all of the weird people that put on like Robbie Williams karaoke soundtracks and sang along to Angels. That's what I'm remembering. Like, no, I don't think I became friends with them. But yeah, no, I did.
Yeah, like I mean, open mics can be enjoyable places, but like, I mean, when any open mic night that I go to, I think I've genuinely been in the minority because I'm not getting up to play. It's normally a room full of people that are getting up to play. It's very rare.
100%.
It's very, like, I mean, must be like 80-20 people playing to.
I did one recently,
hunters,
just before Union Chapel, this beginning of this year. And yeah, exactly. The whole room was just full of people waiting for their turn, really, to play.
It's the same with comedy. Like, you see all these like sort of comedians kind of looking at their... I was in New York once at an open mic night thing, and you could just see all like the list of like comedians that are like, you know, reading their bit and trying to figure it all out and then getting up to do it. And you're like, well, there's no actual fans here. But the thing is, it's a great place to sort of learn your craft, really, isn't it? Would you suggest it to like somebody who's starting out now?
Each their own.
Yeah.
You know, it was my path, but I know there's some bands where it just wouldn't work for them to do that sort of thing. They'd prefer just to probably just play every night as a band in their, you know, backyard or whatever, than go to open mics. There's tons of them in London. I mean, I wouldn't be able to say whether it's a great thing to do or not, but I think it made me appreciate having, you know, my own show and my own fans for the first time a lot. Like, after doing it for so long, the reason I did it before Union Chapel was because it was my first big gig in London I'd done for a few years. So I was just really, almost dreading it, really. You know, it's in this thing like, oh, it's in 6 weeks. Oh, God, it's in 5 weeks. Oh, shit, it's in 4 weeks. And it just...
You need to get road ready.
It was, yeah, and it was sort of like I was not enjoying any of time because I was so anxious about this tour starting in Union Chapel. And what happens if I sing badly? And what happens if I forget my words? What happens if the whole show ends up being just crap? And
can you not get over that by the stage, having played so many gigs? Like, surely, like...
No, I was really, like, struggling. And then I was like, I'm going to go do an open mic. If I get maybe a few open mics under my belt, live performances, maybe my nerves will be better, because it was just all building up to that. And London was the first show of the tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it, and I, like, put my name down. It was, like, 27. You know, there's 26 people before me.
Did you not
me.
pull the, do you know who I am?
No, absolutely not. And then I think I put, like, my missed out my middle name, Rose, and just put Lucy Parton down. And then sat there from 7, and I went up at 10:30. So I'd seen all these other people play and watched all these other people. And then by the time it was my turn, I was, like, really, like, grateful that it was my turn to get up. Like, I was, like, wanting to play, you know, like... I've sat and watched all these people, and now, you know, I'm
ready.
Yeah, I'm ready to play my songs. Totally different to, like, and I thought, oh God, how terrible is it that I remember all of this feeling of waiting for my moment just to play an open mic, and my moment that people would watch me and wish, you know what I mean, wish that one day I'd be able to play Union Chapel with my fans. And that day has come, and I'm not even enjoying it, because I'm such a moron. So that was kind of like what that reality check that I had.
How did the gig go?
It was great. I mean, we had this first thing where we started, the whole thing started with like a long sort of piano instrumental thing that I play. And then the bass just like wasn't working. And Ben was just looking at me like scared, like big wide eyes, like,
yeah,
I don't it's know not what's working. Happening. My bass isn't working. And then I was like, fuck, we're going to have to start a song. And it was actually ended up being really funny, and it was really good because it just
broke the
ice. And I was like, right, Ben, I can see you're panicked, but there really is no need to be panicked because the worst has happened. So we're fine.
It's only up from here, baby.
Exactly.
My question is, your name is Lucy Rose Parton.
Yeah.
Did you not call it like Lucy Parton? Dolly Parton, did you not like
well, I thought that was the problem.
I was gonna say, like, did was that like a,
yeah, it was definitely a thought
we were like going, I can't call myself Lucy Parton because people are gonna think that I'm Dolly Parton's daughter or something.
Exactly, yeah.
Was that it?
Yeah.
So it was just Lucy Rose?
Yeah, my full name's Lucy Rose Parton, and I just was like, Lucy Rose Parton, shall I just get rid of the Parton? Everyone will always talk about Dolly Parton, everyone will ask you if you're related in every interview.
Yeah, yeah.
Do I want that? Probably not.
So the Latin America tour,
mm-hmm.
Do we call it a tour? Do you call it an experiment? What is
I mean,
it?
I guess I call it a tour because I played gigs every night for 8 weeks.
You got big brass balls doing that. Like, I could never go and do that. Cause like explain for the uninitiated, like what it was.
Well, I guess that I was at sort of end of my second record and felt, I think, slightly compromised in ways as a musician that I'd made, you know, like I've mentioned already, maybe in some bits have infiltrated in, and maybe if I'd made some wrong decisions here and there and a bit lost of who I am, sort of thing, especially when it comes to music, a bit lost. And then I kind of just kept seeing on Twitter people saying, please come to Mexico, please come to Brazil. And
that's always the one, like, isn't it? Come to Brazil.
Come to Brazil. And my biggest like Spotify listenership was in countries in Latin America. And I was like, wow, I've never
that's
been
crazy,
there.
Isn't
I've
it?
Yeah, I've never been there. And I've got these people, like my biggest listenership is over there. And so then I sort of, as a thing of like, oh, the touring was finished in the UK and Europe. And it's like end of the record campaign. And now you need to think about the next one. And I was just like, I don't think I'm ready to think about what's next at the moment because I felt so lost. Like, I think I want to go and do some gigs in Latin America, and tried to do it that way. And obviously it was like shut down on every occasion that was not possible. And you can't do that. And you can't go to Latin America and play gigs and no one will book you and all those reasons. So then I was like, right, well, I'm going to go traveling. I've never been traveling. And I know friends have had gap years and, you know, found time to go and do that whole traveling experience.
That's what you're meant to do. You're meant to go and live your life, aren't you?
Yeah,
you're meant to
I'm
go experience things.
Live my life for a bit and do some traveling. So then me and my husband like both wanted to just go to Latin America anyway. And then I just felt a bit guilty that I was going to be there and not play music. Like if I was in these towns that people have been tweeting me for, you know, years saying, I wish you would come here, and I was there just not doing anything. I just felt a bit guilty. So that kind of was the reason why I put the post out saying, right, I'm going to do this traveling. If you do want me to come play in your town, if you can just put me up and find me somewhere to play that has to be free entry, it's not being ticketed because I'm paying for this all myself pretty much. So I don't want anyone, you know, to have to lose money to come and see me play. I'll be there.
Did you not think about like going, well, this is an opportunity for you to go and see these audience, these fans, and they'll obviously want to buy tickets to come see you because they're huge fans. So like essentially you paid to play for them, which is incredibly noble.
Well, I was going to do it anyway. I was going to go travel anyway. So I just felt like, oh, everything's such a business move. And often with music, like we all know that the big problem with, or one of the big problems with the music industry is that it's profit based and everything's about money. And if money had nothing to do with it, what would the music industry be like? If it had nothing to do with making money, probably very different. And I just thought I was going to spend this anyway. So why have I got to now think about them paying for my trip around Latin America? That's like, that was never the point of this, wasn't so I get a free trip around America, like Latin America. Like I was happy to pay for my flights, you know, they're already going to put me up, so my accommodation was covered, you know. So it was, it just felt like it would have been wrong to ticket.
What countries were you going to, and where were you playing?
We started in Ecuador, went down Peru, Chile, Argentina, then Uruguay, Paraguay, Brazil, and Mexico.
Oh my god! Like that's I'm not gonna say all of them, but that's
it was
like
a big proportion of them. Yeah,
like three quarters of
managed
it. Really.
To like, I mean, it was amazing. Obviously, that sort of small documentary that we made, like 20-minute documentary, tells a really great story of what it was about. But it was amazing. Got to see a lot of amazing things. Meet a lot of great people.
So when you come back from that trip, what does that sort of bring to you and bring to the table when it comes to like next moves?
Well, next moves, it was it because every night sort of like I was just there for them. It wasn't about me playing the set or the songs that I thought I wanted to play. It became like a Lucy Rose karaoke night, really, where it's like, play Middle of the Bed, play that, play Shiver, play that, please play this, play Gamble, play this, play Nightbus, you know, play Nebraska. Like, it was really insightful to see which songs had mattered to people.
Did it follow a pattern? Like the songs that people really liked?
Yeah, I felt like it followed a pattern. I don't know, it felt like up until that point, like songs like Shiver were the ones at that point where it was like, oh, that one's too sad, you can't play that one at a festival. Or should we play Shiver because it will bring, you know, everyone will start talking over it at gigs. And that was like a conversation that was had repeatedly within my band about whether that was like part of the set. And I think that sort of made me lose direction because Shiver was my favourite song and I just ended up not playing it thinking that no one wanted it because it was too sad. So I think the thing about doing that tour about Latin America is like that was the song that everybody wanted and everyone would sing to and everyone would cry to. And I guess that just gave me a different look on life and music, which was, you know, I never wanted to become too self-indulgent, but I guess it enabled me to become self-indulgent within my music because I am now, I think. It's all about me and how I feel and me exploring the depth of my own emotions.
But that's what it's meant to be, isn't it, really?
I guess it is, but it
takes a while to get there.
But I think it's seen as sometimes a bad thing, you know, like to be so self-indulgent because it doesn't seem like a good quality. But within music, I've decided for me that it is a good quality, like, and it is something that's important to me, and also that honesty to my fans, which isn't, you know, it's the opposite of what we were talking about before. You've got two choices, which is I'm going to be the opposite of self-indulgent and fulfilling my own creative journey and void that I want to do, and I'm going to make music that I think lots of people are going to like and make them very happy. That's totally fine. But I decided that trip for me was a turning point, which was like, no, I'm going to express myself in the truest form that I possibly can with a music that I don't think, you know, probably a lot of people won't like, but for the people that do, and for the people I think are my fans, really, they will appreciate. So it kind of enabled me to have the confidence to do that and become hopefully the artist that I'd you know, want to be.
Do you feel closer to your fan base now because you're doing everything yourself? Like, you're proper DIY now?
To be honest, no. I felt like after that third record, I felt really close to my fan base. I'd lived with them. I was like living in their houses. And I would spend hours after every gig talking to everybody at merch. And that was amazing. But I was exhausted. I was truly exhausted at a certain point, a breaking point before this, making this fourth record, which is obviously a lot sadder. I was just exhausted. And every part of my life was for the purpose of my music. And I didn't have anything left for me, you know. And I think meeting somebody and having a partner that, you know, their life is equally important as well. It was important for me to, like, I had never really prioritized myself or him or us or our lives outside of my own music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that meant I had to take some of me back. And my fans had every part of me.
Yeah.
And I did have to take some of me back. And that's kind of what I've done on this record. And it kind of breaks my heart a bit because I don't know if it's the right decision or not.
But the thing about it is you'll know in time. Yeah. Whether it was,
I mean, I've just stayed off social media. I've not gone out and spent 2 hours a night talking to people. But when I do leave the venue, once we've packed up, of course, if anyone's waiting at the car or anything, I'd love to chat to them. I just haven't put myself out there.
Is that not exhausting in itself? Like, because with the type of music that you make and how it touches your fans, it means that they could maybe be very intense, like, because, like, they've got an intense love for you and your music, which means that means that they can maybe share things with you that might be a little bit heavier. Like, you're coming off a show and you're in a really good mood and you're going out and you're meeting people and chatting to them and all the rest, and then somebody will share something from the depths of their soul that they mightn't have told anybody else, like about themselves or some secrets or family stuff or whatever. And then, like, you know, that's a real conflict of emotion where you're on a high and then you're brought down there. Like, is that...
I'm never really on that much of a high after a gig, to be honest. I'm already there, really, on like a pensive, deeply sort of emotional sense. I'm not really like buzzing on a, yay, that was really happy. I was really happy doing that. Because, to be honest, at the moment when I'm performing live, I question a lot whether I am even happy doing it because it's so intense. You know, it's not like everyone's jumping up and down, you know. It's like, it's really, the word happy and what I do don't really coincide. And that's really complicated as well, part of it all. When people share, I love the intensity. I love the openness. Like, anything with depth I am into. It's just the quantity is what's too difficult to do. You know, like, 2 hours, 3 hours, and then it's just like the quantity is too much.
I know personally, like, I'd be way too sensitive for that sort of stuff. Like, when somebody tells me something awful or confides me in something, I kind of feel like I latch on to what they're feeling, and it gets it gets really
You're
heavy.
Like an empath.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm the same. I mean, I've cried a lot, you know, with fans telling me what they've gone through and why certain songs, I've cried a lot. However, from someone that has gone through things as well, like we all have, somehow for me it feels like it's shameful. Like, you don't talk about it because it's going to make other people sad, and you bottle it all up inside you. And I am definitely one of those people that I'd much rather they come and talk to me and tell me be able to, like, talk about it without feeling guilty. They've got nothing to feel guilty about. Like, the way I process it is my own thing. Like, if I want to pretend that I'm the world's a beautiful place with nothing bad and people don't grieve, and then that conversation's bringing me down, that I feel like that's my own issue in a way. Whereas, like, to be able to process complex and difficult stories is part of what the sort of human that I want to be able to be. To be able to do that,
it's crazy though. Like, because, like, you, when you start out writing, like, strumming a couple of chords, you don't really think about the pastoral care and the human connection on that level.
You start out
to do one thing, and it becomes something very different. And some people are able to deal with that, and some people aren't. I'd never beget anybody the fact that they maybe don't come out and do 2 hours chatting to their fans. Do you know, like, some people just don't listen.
I feel so guilty.
Some people
I feel
don't
so
have,
terrible at the moment that I'm not doing
like,
it.
Like, I feel like if you're that sort of person and can do it, brilliant. Like, even better for the fans. But if you're not, like, that's not your job either. Your job is to
be
a musician and be an artist. It's not to be
just got to find your own limits, I guess, don't you? Like you said.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's different with every other sort of people. So I absolutely adore Paul Weller, and Paul Weller seems to be, like, your number one fan.
He's amazing. Yeah. I mean, I'm very lucky that he has somehow paid attention to my music and enjoyed it and supported me through it. And then being able to tour with him and sing on his last album was brilliant. I could spend a lot of time talking about how important his support is. I mean, my last record, he sent me a hilarious text being like, "Lucy, I just listened to your new record. It's very down. I thought you'd be happier now you're married." That's it.
Like, it's good to have, like, Uncle Paul there,
it's great.
For an alternative view.
Really enjoyed it. Before as well, we were doing some rehearsing for, like, a John Martin tribute night we were doing.
Yeah.
And I was like, "I've got fretless bass on the album." He was like, Why?
I read
he was
that.
Just
actually.
Like, "Why are you doing that?" And I was like, "I love it." And he was like, "No, that's not for me."
Yeah, like,
I love his honesty.
Isn't that? You'd think that we actually would, like, pay these seagulls. Just
everyone should move to Brighton
as Atmos.
That's what me and Phil think.
We both live here now. Are we going to go for pints? Yeah,
100%. I mean, that's the problem. Moving somewhere.
I need
friends.
It's Wednesday and it's 12:34. We probably shouldn't go for pints now, but we shall.
At some point, definitely.